This is the Injury Pros Podcast, a serious and engaging look at how injuries impact us, the professionals behind it, and the strength it takes to represent the injured. We break down litigation strategy, medical expertise, real-life questions and stories, and the evolving landscape of where our industry is headed next. The Injury Pros starts now. Today, we have a special guest today. His name is Josh Gropper, all the way from New York City. Welcome, Josh.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for having me.
So you're a trial attorney. You've been a trial attorney for how long?
Well, I was admitted in 1992, moved over to personal injury in 95, 96. So it's been a good 30 years, give or take.
You look good.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
So you're here today with the Injury Pros, and we want to hear your story and from beginning to end and where you're at now. And you have a nice growing practice up in New York and New Jersey, and maybe growing into Pennsylvania. We want to hear about that. But first, tell us where you grew up.
Well, I bounced around a lot. I was kind of an Army brat, except my dad didn't work for the Army. He was kind of in IT and tech, and he would bounce not only from job to job, but from industry to industry. So I grew up in New York, New Hampshire, Southern California, back to Long Island, college in D.C., law school in Boston.
Wow.
Bounced around quite a bit. And I think it actually helped shape my personality. I always hated to be the new kid, but it taught me over time, if you don't want to be the new kid and the shy kid and whatnot, you really got to put yourself out there. And it probably made me more extroverted than I otherwise
would. That's interesting, because I moved once in fourth grade and I was a quiet kid. So that transition from the city where I had 60 kids on my block to the suburbs where I had like one friend within a mile, it was a tough transition for me in fourth grade.
Yeah.
But you did that multiple times, right?
I learned. Yeah, I did it multiple times. And I was always the new kid and I was always the shy kid and introverted. And then by the time I moved back to the New York area in the middle of eighth grade, I sort of vowed that I wasn't going to let that happen again. And I became very popular over the course of the next few years. And I ran for vice president of the high school. I think it really, in retrospect, helped shape my personality, made me much more extroverted than I would have otherwise.
And you get to know people from different areas and get to know yourself too, because you have to deal with making new friends, and it's a lot of hurdles for a young person.
Yeah. Times were tough, and especially I joke around because I was hitting puberty. I was in Southern California, the most beautiful women in the world, and then my dad uprooted us and took us to Long Island, and it was like, oh, Dad, you're killing me.
Not the same, huh? Okay. So so after high school, what did you do?
After high school, college in D.C., lucky enough to get a scholarship down at American University. And then I took a year off. I traveled across country with a good buddy of mine and came home to Long Island, New York, and decided shortly thereafter I wanted to pursue what I thought I always would want to pursue, which was law school. Went to school up in the Boston area. And that's when my life and career kind of took a funky turn. I was a second year law student. It was 1989. And I was a second year law student at Boston University. I went to sleep at night studying for a final exam. And I woke up to a phone call at 5 a.m. that my younger brother, Danny, had been in a horrific fire. My dad called. He said, basically, drop everything, get to New York. Your brother's been in a terrible fire. He's probably not going to make it. So I told my roommates, please let the teacher know. It literally was the morning of the final exam.
Goodness.
I hopped on a train, got down to New York, and my brother had suffered second and third degree burns over 80% of his body. Obviously a huge traumatic event, and brought the family together. Also kind of shaped my career, though, because through that process, in addition to all the time that we spent with the healing, one of the things that I did is I went around and I interviewed the top flight personal injury lawyers in New York to represent Danny and the family. We ended up hiring a very good law firm, very good attorney. It went all the way to trial. I actually sat in on the trial for a week and I watched, from the point of view of an injured person and their family, what it's like to be represented by a top flight personal injury attorney. And having seen not only what they could do and what they did do for Danny and for the family, I sort of pivoted my career. Prior to this incident, I had accepted a kind of a boring corporate job out in the San Francisco area as a second year law student, but I ended up deciding I wanted to become a personal injury lawyer instead. And so have devoted my career the last 30 years to representing accident victims and their families.
That's a story right out of the bat.
Yeah.
So you were up in Boston area, I think you said, right, when you heard the news.
Mm-hmm.
And he was your younger brother.
Yeah, only sibling, three years younger.
Only brother.
Yeah. Right?
So he's 3 years younger. And what was he doing with his life about that time?
He had gone to Florida State University for a year or two. Didn't really, kind of missed his friends. He had a very strong peer group in the New York area, very, very attached to the local guys. So he came back and became a commuting student. He attended Hofstra University as a business student. And was kind of doing odd jobs. I think he was pumping gas at night.
Living at homes?
He was living at the time. My parents had been divorced. My dad had already moved on. I think by this time he was up in Vermont. And my mom had recently moved away to Florida with her new spouse. So Danny was in a townhouse with a couple other guys in a town called Island Park, New York, which was right near where we grew up in Oceanside. And that's where the fire broke out.
Gotcha.
And
So when you got the news, obviously it was shocking. Your dad called you said, right?
Yep.
Did he tell you about anything that happened?
I think
how it happened?
Yeah. Just house fire. It's bad. Get to New York. There weren't, you know, the details kind of unfolded over the course of the next few days as to what happened and how, you know, Danny sort of found himself in the position he found himself in and how he got trapped. It was just kind of a wrong place, wrong time thing where his roommates all thought that he was going to be sleeping out that night. He came home and he passed out. And he was in a room that wasn't his room. So when the fire broke out, everyone looked in Danny's room and said, oh, you know, he was sleeping out. And he kind of got trapped in the dining room. And by the time the firemen got to him, the fire had really...
So he was the only one at home at the time?
Well, when the fire broke out, I think everyone was home.
Oh, okay.
But they had plenty of time to get out. They just didn't realize Danny was there.
Okay. So what did we learn about the cause of the fire? Because you had said you had a case.
Yeah. It was... So the origin of the fire was, we think, one of my brother's roommates likely falling asleep, either with a cigarette or a funky cigarette. And that probably was the ignition of the fire. But the issue was when they had moved into the place a week or so earlier, the fire alarms were not working. They had reported the fire alarms not working.
Oh, okay.
So the argument was, you know, had the landlord and managing agent and the owner provided the proper fire alarm, Danny would have and could have gotten out.
Gotcha. Now, did it happen in the middle of the night? Do we know?
Yeah.
Okay, so he was sleeping as far as we know.
Correct.
So there wasn't a big explosion. It was just a fire that eventually crept in and took over the premises. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Gotcha.
So how did it come about that they found Danny inside?
He had apparently made his way to the dining room. He doesn't have any recollection of this, it being such a traumatic event, but apparently he got, at some point on his own, he got towards the door, but a dining room table or something fell on him. And so he was sort of pinned and trapped by the time the firemen got in there and got him.
They found him?
They found him.
And he was, I know I met him before, so how would you describe his burns?
Oh, horrendous. He was... He referred to himself as a crispy critter. He was just, his whole body was raw and pink, and it was bad. And honestly, that wasn't even the worst of it. It was what happens with burns, which you know we've learned as personal injury lawyers, is the farthest away from your heart gets the less blood. So the fingers and the toes, in particular, are very vulnerable.
Yeah.
When there's a burn. So the worst of it was in the weeks following the fire, what would happen is the doctors would come to us and say, you know, we think Danny can live, but we have to amputate a couple of his fingers or a couple of his toes. And since Danny was in a coma, he couldn't make those decisions for himself. And since my parents were divorced, neither of them wanted to take responsibility. So it sort of fell to me to make these horrible decisions about, sort of signing away his body parts bit by bit. And as you know, Danny is a quadruple amputee at this point with, no hands and no legs.
So was that all because of amputation?
It was to prevent infection.
Wow.
Yeah. But it was a slow process. It wasn't like they came to us in one shot and said, hey, he's going to have to lose his hands and his legs. It was literally a finger and a toe at a time.
Oof.
And it was a brutal few weeks. And honestly, when Danny came out of the coma and recognized, you know, that he had these decisions and he could make them on his own, and that he appreciated and approved of what I had done, and that he wanted to live no matter what the outcome, took a huge burden off of me, because he was a very vain young man. As a teenager, he never passed a mirror or a reflection without posing.
He's quite a character, just knowing him now.
Yeah, I almost don't talk about him as a, you know, it's hard to, because when people hear quadruple amputee, burn survivor, it's always like, I would never want to live that way. But once you meet Danny.
Yeah, he's full of life.
He's just incredibly inspirational, full of life, like you say. And he's changed my perspective and the perspective of countless others. You know, I'm sure you come away from our dinners and in the seminars and say, wow, man, you know, if he.
Yeah, when things are tough in life, you realize what this guy has went through.
Yeah.
The positive attitude that he has, it just rubs off on you.
It does.
Like you can go think about, hey, Danny is always positive every time I've seen him. He's always happy, always having a good time. He's always talking to everybody. And, you know, life can't be that bad for us, right?
Right. Our day-to-day, how am I going to meet payroll, or what bills I have, or what decisions I have to make at home, they pale by comparison.
So was he, that unconsciousness, was that from the fire? Was that like induced because of the possibility of infection or pain?
Originally from the fire. And then, they induced the coma just to keep him chill, you know, during the process.
Yeah.
And again, it dragged on for a lot longer than I thought it would.
How long was he in the hospital initially?
Yeah, he was in the burn unit itself for about 6 months. And then he was in the rehab center immediately adjacent to the burn unit for another year. So a total of 18 months confined to.
Was he still treating for the burns while he was in the rehab center?
Well, occasionally. By that time, the procedures were not so much amputations or life-saving procedures. They were more, I guess, cosmetic in nature, in terms of there's a pulling of the skin that goes on. So there would be these release procedures that would go on. I think he had a total of 18 or 19 total surgeries.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, he really went through it.
So this was first year of law school?
This was second year of law school.
All right. And then did you ever make up that final? How did that work?
You know, it's a great question. I think I did make up those finals that semester. At the time, the law school that I was going to, Boston University, had a strict policy about people being able to transfer in a way where they would still get the degree from Boston University, but they, given what occurred to Danny, they made an exception. So I finished up, I guess, the finals for that semester, but then I spent the next year and a half down at Hofstra University Law School.
Close to the home?
It was a mile from the hospital.
Okay.
So I could be with Danny every day. And
was he living at the rehab?
He was living in the hospital. He was living at the rehab. I was a mile down the road at essentially a dorm for Hofstra Law.
Oh, okay.
And the two schools worked it out so that I still graduated with the degree from Boston U, which was the better school. So that was very cool of them.
That's cool and that's impressive. Yeah. So American, where you got a scholarship.
Yeah.
Like an academic scholarship?
Academic scholarship. They were looking to, I guess, raise their SAT scores or whatnot. So they gave me a full ride down there.
That so you had nice. A good SAT score?
I had a good SAT score. But then I picked the most expensive law school in the country to make up for it by going to Boston University.
That's pretty impressive.
So I took on some loans there. And funny side note, though, is that Boston University was so difficult. It was a grind. They were really trying to make their way into, I think they were top 20 law school back in the late 80s, early 90s. And they were trying to shoot for even higher. So the academics, they were very rigorous. It was brutal. And then when I went to Hofstra, by comparison, even though I had the Danny down the road hours, I just found it was like being back in college. It was like a cakewalk.
What was your third year though, too, right?
It was my third year. That helped.
Was like, for me, the first year was super hard.
Yeah.
Super stressful. You don't know if you're going to pass or fail. For me, you know, college was more about having a good time. You know, I was an accounting degree, so we did whatever we could to get by, right? And a lot of partying. And then I finally applied myself in law school. But it's, you know, you go there and I don't know, we had 100-something people in our class at Widener University, Delaware Law School, and they say 15-20% are not going to be here next year. And you wonder, are you going to be that person? Because you didn't get a grade until the end of the semester, because we only, I believe we only had finals back then.
Right.
So you're going that whole semester, you're reading every day, you're studying every Sunday all day, like, and you don't know if you're going to pass. And you have no history of this. So it's not like I made it last semester. All I got to do is study harder than that and I'll make it. Like,
that's true.
It's that first semester that was really stressful because you didn't know. You didn't know if you could cut out for it. You didn't know if you're going to pass that test, no matter how good you did. Right. So it was that. And then made it through that year. Okay. There was a lot of people missing second year. And then second year, was you still had those core courses, some electives, and it was a little bit easier. And then I, you know, I had my first clerkship working at a lawyer in Wilmington, Delaware, that first summer after first year. And then I continued that like 30, 35 hours a week during second year, just to keep busy and earn some extra money, get some experience. And then third year, it was even more. It was almost 40 hours, but third year is a lot easier.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if that had any effect on it. But at Boston U, maybe it was hard all 3 years.
I didn't stick around for the third, so I couldn't tell you, but. What I was going to say is that I found myself with so much extra free time at Hofstra that I wandered over to the undergrad campus. They were putting on Hamlet by William Shakespeare, and I auditioned.
Okay.
And I got the role of the king, Claudius. Wow. So in addition to visiting Danny and spending my third year of law school, I got to perform in Hamlet, which was
You were bound to be a trial lawyer here. Smart guy, you know. Ride to American University, then gets in the Boston U, then has this life-changing experience with your brother, which gives you the drive. Now you're in a play, right? You're taking the lead of the play, just like a trial lawyer in court, right? What, I don't know if you could have done anything else.
Well, I wouldn't say it was the lead. Hamlet himself, of course, is the big part.
But I don't know.
The King Claudius was a meaty role and a great role. And I had done some Shakespeare in college, and I was in the Maryland Shakespeare Festival, which was near where I went to school. I spent a couple summers down there. I did catch the acting bug in college. And then I do think there's a relationship as a trial lawyer.
That's what they say.
Aspect.
I can't say I've ever done that. But I hear from a lot of the top trial attorneys around the country that it's one of the best things you can do. Right. So why do you feel it was very good for your trial lawyer career? Like, tell us from the inside, you know, your own experience and why you feel that's helped you in your career.
Yeah, I was always, well, I'll tell you a formative experience, and maybe it'll shed light on, in a roundabout way, I'll get to answer your question.
Yeah, sure.
When I was a young man, and I was going to elementary school in New Hampshire, we went to see, it was a field trip, and we went to see a play. It was called 1776. I don't know if you've ever seen the play or not. It's been on Broadway a few times. It's a wonderful play. So I had never seen a play before, musical or otherwise, and I was just so blown away. What I thought at the time was the subject matter of the play, because it was all about the politicians in Philadelphia sitting around ready to sign the Declaration of Independence, but it was set to song. And I thought, wow, you know, I want to be a politician because of what I saw in that play and how beautifully it was portrayed. And it was only later, much later, that I realized part of what I loved about that field trip experience was the performance aspect of it.
Okay.
Was that they brought to life a story on stage. And so fast forward to American University, I was in a literature class, an elective. In my freshman year, I was taking Shakespeare, wonderful teacher down there. And one of the students was a kid by the name of Paul Valley, who was went on to become a soap opera star, a very, very handsome young man. He was an actor and had always been an actor. And he convinced me in the Shakespeare class, hey, they're doing Taming of the Shrew across campus. Why don't you audition for it? He said, I've never acted. But he sort of dragged me there. And so then I caught the acting bug. So I think my I was always sort of meant to be a trial lawyer, but it was just the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle had to fall into place, whether that was my attraction to politics and law, my attraction to performance or whatnot. And I've also, like you, I think, have the kind of analytical mind, you know, that where we can succeed in law school and as attorneys by analyzing facts in a certain way and applying the law and whatnot. Yeah. And I think we just think logically.
Yeah.
And that helps us.
Sounds like the full experience, the prep. Did you work for any type of like prosecutor's office or public defender to get any trial work in the beginning or anything? How did you cut your teeth?
Yeah, great question. I came out of law school at a time kind of like today, where it's very, very difficult for young people today to find a job. Again, now we're talking AI and other reasons. But
yeah.
When I graduated law school in 1991, legal jobs were very sparse. And I waited tables for about a year looking for work. I finally landed with a collection law firm. They got their cases from Dun & Bradstreet. Okay. And it was basically businesses that were owed money, $5,000, $10,000. It was what we call
volume.
Goods sold and delivered. And literally my first day on the job, they would hand me a couple of files and they would say, you know, you got three trials today. I said, what do you mean I got three trials today? And literally, you'd go down there, there'd be these judicial hearing officers, they'd do these bench trials. You'd have a witness, you'd have documents. And, you know, I got my teeth handed to me because I didn't know how to question a witness or cross-examine the other side or get documents into evidence. But, you know, obviously you do dozens and dozens of these things and it sort of prepares you.
Yep. That and you get your confidence, right?
Right.
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 And you were also, you just said you were a server or waiter, right? So yeah, you got the sales aspect of being a lawyer, right?
You know, waiting tables, honestly, I waited tables in college, I waited tables in law school, and I waited tables when I graduated from law school. And I always say, if you can wait tables, you can do anything, because it just teaches you so many different, to be able to walk a circuit where your first table is just getting seated, but they need to be addressed, your last table is on dessert, someone wants their check, to be able to
manage it,
juggle it all, make that loop with a smile on your face, it's easier said than done.
And sell, you know, sell and communicate with people and where they're at in life and that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
I did that in college too. And
you waited?
I was a bartender at a country club in law school. We would, I think I would work Friday nights, either weddings or whatever, usually a wedding or some kind of event, probably make about $110. And that field gave me money for Saturday night where we had to go out to the town, have a good time, just to blow off some steam.
Sure.
So then we had to wake up on Sunday and hopefully recover from the night before and then study all day, maybe go to the gym in the middle and study the rest of the day. That's what law school was like, especially for the first 2 years.
Yeah. Did you study to be a bartender? Because I tried to fake it as a bartender a couple of times.
I didn't go well. I believe I took one of those classes, right? And turned out to be, I think I went to one day because we didn't have Zoom or any of that kind of stuff back then. This was back in 2000, yeah, right around the turn of the millennium there. And it turned out to be a bunch of flashcards because you had to memorize what was in the drinks. So there might have been 100 drinks you had to memorize the flashcards. And there was really little hands-on, like special pours and all that kind of stuff. So I did it at a country club, but that's how I got by cash-wise.
That's great.
To fuel the stress relief that if we can go out Saturday night and spend a lot of time in Philadelphia or wherever at the clubs or wherever we did. So that was it. So, all right. So you worked at this this collection firm for what? How many years?
I spent about 2 years there. Okay. I was looking to transition into personal injury.
Why were you looking personal injury? Just because your brother?
Yeah, based on what happened to my brother, I knew that's what I wanted.
Because you saw those lawyers in court. Obviously, you saw what happened to your brother, and you believe it could have been prevented, right?
The incident could have been prevented. Oh, absolutely. But I also saw my brother having settled and won his case.
And they took it all the way to trial. So you got to see it a lot. You were part of that from day one.
Yeah.
Whole recovery process, mentally, physically, just there and absorbing everything.
Absolutely. And the effect that the money has had on my brother's life, because he just hasn't had to worry about money because he got a chunk up front and he gets a chunk a month for the rest of his life.
So like a structure.
Yeah. And we chose a lifetime structure as opposed to it ending at a certain time. And, you know, so he'll get that money every month.
I'm glad there was, knowing Danny, I'm glad there was a big insurance policy.
Yeah.
Because some of these rental properties, you said it was like a townhouse, right?
Yeah.
And they could be owned by mom and pop that has the minimum insurance at that mortgage that's on that place, maybe 100, 200, 300,000.
Yeah.
That's going to be, that wouldn't even pay for what, a month, a week? In the burn unit, right?
No. Burns are very expensive. Burn treatment is very expensive.
Very intensive, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah, so the fact that the financial burden was lifted from him and from the family,
that's great.
Inspired me to want to pursue a career in personal injury. And as soon as I could segue in there from the collection firm, I was fortunate enough to go work at a law firm where they did both personal injury and commercial litigation.
Okay.
And they needed somebody who could do a little of both. So the fact that I had the couple years collections experience got me in the door there. And then when I was there, I gravitated towards the personal injury practice, stayed there for about 18 months, and then opened my own shop in 1994, 1995.
Okay.
Really haven't looked back since.
So how do you open your own shop back then? I know times have changed, technology's changed, the business has changed. What was it like back in those times, 1995-ish? In where? New York City? In Manhattan?
New York City. I was in Lower Manhattan. I was working at this pretty substantial personal injury, workers' compensation, and commercial litigation law firm. They were clock watchers. They would, it was important when you came and when you left.
Yeah.
It wasn't so important what you did and what your results
were. The old days of thinking.
Man, so it used to drive me crazy. And I was on trial for them out in Suffolk County on a trial, and I ended up settling it. But I was away from the office for a couple of days. So my work and mail had piled up. I remember this distinctly. I went in on set both Saturday and Sunday to catch up. And I was so exhausted that by the time I showed up Monday morning, I didn't roll in at my usual 8:30 or 9. I think I rolled in at 9:30 or 10. And the senior partner was at the receptionist area, went to talk to the junior partner, who came in to talk to me about my tardiness problem. After a trial and working all weekend,
yeah,
which
yeah.
they didn't know,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So I gave notice immediately. And I didn't have a place to go and I didn't have clients, but
uh-huh.
I started wandering around the neighborhood. You'll like this story. I went to a law suite a couple blocks away from where I had worked. And the gentleman who was running the law suite was touring the offices. And he said, you know, this one's $1,800 a month. This one's $1,500 a month. And as we were walking down the hallway, I said, how about this one? He said, what one? And I said, this space right here. He said, that's not an office. That's where we're going to put a file cabinet. There's no door. There's no nothing. And I said, I'll give you $500 a month for it. And he said, you won't have privacy. You won't have anything. I said, I don't care. You have a conference room. I'll just room my stuff in here. So that's what I did. I rented a space in a hallway for $500 a month.
Closet, basically.
It was probably smaller than a closet. And I bought a desk at IKEA. And I would meet clients.
Put it together yourself, I'm sure.
Yeah, it was.
You didn't pay anybody to put it together back then.
No, and I'm not really too good with an Allen wrench, so. So it was a painful process, but you know, you start with humble beginnings. And what I did to, you know, kind of pay the bills is I just did per diem work. I would just tell other attorneys that I knew, hey, you know, I'll be in your county tomorrow. If you got anything on,
yeah,
$50, $75, we'll save you an appearance.
And whatever you need, yeah.
Built up a practice that way.
Okay, and then you focused on personal injury law then, right?
I mean, the per diem was across the board.
Sometimes when you start out, you got to take whatever comes.
Yeah.
Or whatever you can get to pay the bills.
I did have some experience doing some commercial collections and things of that nature, so I would take those cases occasionally. But I would try to gravitate towards the personal injury cases wherever possible.
If you could, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then slowly start building that up.
Yeah, building up that practice.
What year did you start the new practice?
So I went out on my own probably 95. The name has changed a bunch of times, but it's essentially been me up until Chris came into my life about 12, 13 years ago. And, you know, in New York, we've got these incredibly favorable laws for construction accidents. They're known as the labor laws. They're statutory protections for workers above and beyond standard negligence. You know, you have in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, et cetera. And so I started gravitating towards taking on some of the heavier construction accident cases. And, you know, that's been great for our.
You were successful, I assume.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You've tried a bunch of cases from what I hear, right?
Yeah. I got a number of, you know, 6 and 7 figure verdicts. I know that the insurance carriers, that's important to them. They know. When they're about to go to the mat, they'll run a jury verdict search on me and they'll see my verdicts. So, you know, I think there are a lot of attorneys who are all bluff and bluster until the end, and they'll take what they can get at jury selection. And they know if I have to, I'll go to the mat. That being said, you know, I'm also incredibly reasonable, and I urge all of my clients to be incredibly reasonable, because you
don't know what's going to happen.
You never know what 6 people in a box are going to do.
Yeah.
And if they get something in the range of reasonableness,
yep.
You know, why take that chance?
Settlement range, we call it.
Yeah. And it's, of course, it's different for everybody. Everyone's got their own risk tolerance. Yeah. But it you know, it's I think it's comforting to my clients to know that I can go to the mat, have gone to the mat for them with some good results.
So your partner now is Chris Najat, right?
Correct.
Firm name is Gropper and Najat, right?
Yes.
How long has it been Gropper and Najat?
Chris came into my life. I was thinking about this the other day. Chris came into my life, I want to say 2013. So he didn't make partner for maybe 4 or 5 years. So roughly 8 years, I would say he's been partner. His name's been on the door.
Okay.
He helped build up our New Jersey office. We have a satellite office down in Cherry Hill, and he's the main guy there. I'll help out some of the bigger cases with depositions and trials or whatnot, but he essentially runs the New Jersey practice soup to nuts. And likewise, I'll run New York, but Chris is instrumental in helping us and handling this.
I've known Chris probably for about 20 years. That's how I met you. And Chris is a couple years younger than I am, but always been a good lawyer, good business person, good lawyer. So I think you have a good partner there.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. I love him. He's a character, as you know.
Yeah.
But he lights up a room, and he's got such a good heart. And anytime we've had any kind of discussions or negotiations, he's just such a reasonable and easy guy to deal with.
And he respects you the same way. So yeah, that's good. How did you guys meet? Any quick stories you can tell?
Yeah, he answered an ad. I, at the time, back in 2013, I'd had some really bad experiences hiring younger lawyers. I felt like, you know, I'd grown the practice pretty substantially by then. But what would happen is, you know, I'd get these lawyers who'd come work for me full time, and you know, they were younger lawyers, and I'd be willing to train them. But they would go to court in the morning for a conference. They would come back. By the time they get back to the office, it'd be 12 or 1 o'clock. They'd have to take a break for lunch. They'd need to check their email, their stocks, their whatever.
Yeah.
I'd maybe squeeze out another couple hours of work from them in the afternoon. And it occurred to me, you know, this guy went to court and got a preliminary conference order, for example, that I could pay somebody $75 to do. And that person's there every day and knows the judges. And so I started to look at young lawyers as a burden and not as a benefit. And Chris actually flipped the script for me. I got to the point where that business model was no longer working. I was just too busy and I couldn't survive without a younger lawyer. Put an ad out. Chris responded to the ad, came into the office, and we just hit it off right away. He was leaving soon for his wedding in Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
But we hit it off so much, Mike, that
I
walked him downstairs. I think we bought Slurpees at the 7-Eleven.
Oh, I heard this story about the
basement of my building. And then at some point he said, all right, pal, I gotta go. Because I guess it started to turn into some sort of creepy old man who wouldn't let go of the conversation.
I had a good, meaningful first experience.
Yeah, I just bonded with him right away, and I think he felt the same way. And it's been great.
So he was a good associate, obviously, because at some point you made him partner, right?
Yeah, he was. He exceeded expectations in terms of his rainmaking ability. Chris is a business magnet because his personality is so outgoing. He's also very effective at settling cases and dealing with clients. You know, he's always giving out his cell phone number to every client.
Yeah.
He's got a lot of strengths as a lawyer.
Very likable guy, very personable. And it sounds like he's a good lawyer too, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. He's got his strengths. I've got mine. I feel like we're a great team.
Yeah.
You know, and I definitely have weaknesses that he fills and vice versa.
Okay. That's how most partners are. I'm sure I'm like that with my partner.
Yeah. I think what, if you're a good business person, you learn to, take the strengths of the people that you work with.
Yeah.
And if they have weaknesses, you know, you compliment them with other areas. Not to say Chris has weaknesses. I don't want Chris seeing this. And so
no, he's good. So office, your main office is in Manhattan.
Right.
Whereabouts?
We've been at 33rd and Madison. We're about a block from the Empire State Building in there for, again, maybe 13, 14 years. And then Chris runs the satellite office down in Cherry Hill.
So why Manhattan? Is that just the center hub for New York City? I mean, I know it's the heart of New York City, but why not an office in any of the other boroughs, like a satellite office
or
something like
that? Yeah, interesting question. I mean, Manhattan is the heart of New York City and the five boroughs and the surrounding areas. It's just exceptionally easy to get to. So if we've got clients in Brooklyn or the Bronx, for example, which are two of the more favorable venues for plaintiffs, easy subway ride into Midtown Manhattan. If we've got Westchester clients, they take Metro North down to Grand Central, a few blocks from our office. Long Island clients, Penn Station, a few block walk.
Okay.
So it's really centrally located. And for whatever reason, I think Madison Avenue has a certain panache to it.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it's from the Mad Men days or something, but people hear Madison Avenue and they think good things.
So the public transportation is really good for the boroughs coming in and that kind of thing.
Excellent. Yeah.
Yeah. We don't have that too much here. Like, we have a line that comes in from New Jersey, and then we have SEPTA, but, you know, not everybody takes it. So we have a lot of bad traffic, which I'm sure you have too in New York.
Yeah, we've got our share for sure. More mass transit. I've recently relocated personally out to Hoboken, New Jersey. So I take the PATH train now to Herald Square, which is like a 15-minute ride and then a couple block walk to my office. So that's been really lovely for me.
So have you seen it in your practice where most of your clients are meeting on Zoom, or do they still come into the office?
We welcome them to the office, but I think the large majority of our clients want to DocuSign things be on with us by telephone or Zoom or Teams or whatnot. Yeah, I think the large majority of our clients don't care to
stop. Probably the best thing we had coming out of COVID was this way to connect instantly.
Yeah.
And once you do it a few times, you're comfortable on camera, you know, with the Zoom technology. And, you know, why would your clients take off a day of work? They've already missed enough work.
Right.
Their injury.
Right. Absolutely.
Hop on at 3 o'clock, you know, tell your boss you're taking a break, or if they can't do it, you'll wait till 5:30 if you need to and pop right on. They could pop on their phone. It's technology is great today.
And we also had, you may have experienced this down here in Pennsylvania, but in New York, there were numbers of sort of relatively meaningless court appearances where attorneys would have to be dragged into court to fill out these orders that 99% of the time were boilerplate.
Case management orders.
Right.
We have them in Philadelphia, and they just went to Zoom, thank God. Discovery court, 99% of the times they make us work it out before a hearing.
That's great.
You'd have to sit there from like 9 a.m. till 11 just to get your agreement submitted.
Right.
Yeah, so things are just more efficient overall, and I think the clients appreciate that too.
Yeah.
We do, because, you know, you're a litigator. You take a lot of depositions, I'm sure, right?
Yep.
I remember back in the day, like I like to video record all my depositions, when I'm taking them up defendants, right? Use them at trial, whatever, use them for settlement. Mm-hmm. Remember the old days, you'd have to have a camera system, two cameras and all the microphones, and how much would that cost? Yeah. Every time you want to take a deposition.
Yeah.
You know, we just pop on. I had one case resolved last year. It had 26 depositions, I think. And was like, I could never do that back in the old days.
Yeah.
Without a whole team, or we would take it so much time. And probably be five times the cost. So
absolutely, it's definitely streamlined the industry.
So, what's practice like up in New York? You feel it's any different than you've seen in New Jersey with Chris in the office in New Jersey?
How do I compare the two? It's similar. Some of the laws, again, like for construction accidents, are definitely more favorable in New York than New Jersey and other states. But there are a lot of similarities. You know, in New Jersey, they have their Form A interrogatories, whereas we have bills of particular in New York. So it's a lot of it is just different nomenclature, but same in essence, the same practice. It's paper discovery, it's depositions, it's independent medical exams, which aren't so independent.
Yep.
And it's trials. So yeah, it's you know, some of the names are changed, but it's pretty much the same type of practice.
So your firm does mostly catastrophic, more serious injuries, right?
For the most part. Yeah, I've gotten very involved in the burn survivor community. So
tell us about that.
Yeah. So through Danny and his travels, we found this organization called the Phoenix Society for Burn Survivors, which is a wonderful organization. You could Google it. I think it's phoenix-society.org. They provide just amazing support services for people like Danny. Thousands and thousands of burn survivors worldwide. And they come together once every couple of years in what's called the World Burn Congress. So I kind of dragged Danny to one of those thinking it would help him. Our first World Burn Congress was in Baltimore in the early 2000s. And, you know, he was surrounded by people who were like him, you know, had significant burns, some more significant than Danny. And my hope was that he would find support in that. But what's happened is he actually wants to give back more than he gets. So he became sort of the go-to, or one of the go-to people in a program that they have called the SOAR program. SOAR is S-O-A-R, Survivors Offering Assistance in Recovery. What they do is they match up people like Danny who've been through this and have seen light at the end of the tunnel and have this great attitude. Right? Yeah. And with young people who are just now feeling isolated, going through the beginnings of recuperating from a significant burn. So, you know, some young kid in Iowa who's going to lose a finger and is, woe is me, how am I going to ever live my life with nine fingers? We'll get on a Zoom call with Danny, who's just back from Vegas and strip clubs and golfing. And, you know, he'll roll in and, yeah, and he'd change that young man's life. That's a awesome heartbeat. So that the organization is, first of all, a wonderful organization. I can't say enough about it. Phoenix Society for Burn Survivors. We also, it's a sort of a love child or project of mine, is we've developed this seminar called The Healing Power of Laughter, which Danny and I have put on at several World Burn Congresses for new survivors, because I wanted to be able to sort of share Danny's gift,
yeah,
and put him on a platform to be able to allow a little levity, a little laughter in these people's lives, because it's so filled with sorrow and heartache. And I can't tell you how many lives we've changed where people have come up to us and said, in essence, you know, thank you for giving me permission to laugh about this a little. I didn't know I could.
Yeah.
And so this has been such a joyful project that
you guys
we've been involved.
You guys are really giving back in that world. And you're using your resources as an attorney and your relationships and your skill levels to get him in front of more people.
Exactly.
Sounds like.
Exactly. I'm essentially, in this seminar, I'm essentially the straight man. I bring him in. He delivers all the, yeah, the funny lies.
He's a funny guy.
He's a very funny.
I'd love to get him on the podcast someday. Talk
That'd
about
be great.
His experience from a first person point of view. That would be awesome. Now let's get back to, like, you do a lot of burn victim cases, right? You say that's one of your focuses?
It is. Yeah. We'll take in cases involving chemical burns, electrical burns, explosions, like we talked about, propane and otherwise. Sometimes it's a failure to ground. A static electricity will ignite something. Sometimes it's
products. Like,
yeah,
I've had a case where a house started on fire because of an electric blanket. And we have a propane case right now. You know, those are crazy because you see them on the news all the time.
Yeah.
Home leveled, propane, this, that. And the whole house is destroyed. And, you know, I heard another one in New Jersey where my mother-in-law knows one of the victims, and it's a guy's in really bad shape. Like, you know, you're lucky if you survive those things. The whole house is blown apart. They happen more frequently than not, right?
Yeah. Lately, there have been a ton of fire pit cases. I don't know if you're familiar, but a lot of the fire pits that Amazon sells,
okay,
have issues. And you know, Amazon's paying on those. So the thing with burns, you know, knowing firsthand, Danny's gone through it, is they're so insidious. The treatment of burns, the debridement procedures.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that.
Yes.
You know, it's a lot of our listeners know about an injury and, you know, go to the hospital, get some testing, do some physical therapy, you know, those types of different therapies. And then the ultimate is surgery. But burns are a whole different process, right?
Sure. Yeah, it's a whole different
process. Tell us about, like, you know, from the beginning, when the person first gets the burn, assume they're taken, you know, by ambulance or by a family member to the hospital.
Yeah.
What are they looking for? What's the process like? What's the initial treatment like? And kind of walk us through that.
Yeah, great question. A lot of the more significant burns, what happens is they'll go to the local hospital who's not equipped to handle it, and then they'll be helicoptered to a burn center.
Okay.
And, there's a lot of, drug-induced coma and whatnot to deal with the pain. It's a lot of, once that is lifted, morphine drips and things of that nature to deal with the pain. You know, obviously I talked about what my brother went through with the periodic amputations, but even shy of that, what happens is the dead skin needs to be cleaned off. So what burn survivors go through are these really painful debridement procedures, where they go in the quote-unquote tank And essentially, someone takes steel wool and scrapes their skin off.
Steel wool? Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's not a painless procedure. And so it's grueling. And of course, you know, there's the possibility of losing body parts and
infection, right?
Based on sepsis and infection seeping in. So
when
yeah.
When you say the tank, what do you mean by that?
It's a tank. It's a essentially like a bathtub that they go in, and the nurses will, you know, some of the nurses will hold the patient down while the others will essentially take steel wool and get rid of some of
it's really dead skin.
Well, I mean, it's not really steel wool, but it's like steel.
Like steel
that they use. And so these are the kinds of treatments that, you know, these people have to live through. And, you know, we as trialers have to be able to convey, you know, because a lot of times, you know, as you know, you'll a person appearing in court will seem, oh, you know, like they're okay. They're here today, just like you, ladies and gentlemen, the jury. So how bad could it have been? And it's our job to walk through, you know, all that they had to go through to get.
So how do you prove or get the jury to believe the significance of the pain from a burn injury if they've never been through a burn injury? Like, what techniques do you do? Do you have anything you relate it to? Like, how do you do that? Or even to an adjuster to kind of explain like this hell that this burn victim's been through?
Yeah, I mean, having been alongside my brother as he's put into the tank and as he's gone through that kind of procedure by way of example, you know, helps me, I think gives me a perspective that most lawyers probably don't have. You know, we'll do day in the life videos. I'm sure you guys do those as well to try to do the best that we can to document what these people are going through on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, so you lived it. You've firsthand experienced it with your brother, I'm sure, being there for a lot of these procedures.
Right? Yeah.
So you can explain that to an adjuster, somebody like that. But that evidence of you being there doesn't always get in front of a jury if you have to, right?
Right.
So you kind of have to use some kind of other reference or something. And I guess you have experts and doctors coming in.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
To give how things feel on the pain scale. Like those types of things? Or?
Well, pain is interesting because it's subjective, right?
Yeah.
So someone can have a high pain threshold and someone can have a low pain threshold. You know, ideally you want someone from the burn unit themselves to testify.
Yeah.
You know, we heard the screams of the person as we did this procedure. Yeah, because screams are screams,
yeah.
Right?
What advice would you give to families? Would you advise them to kind of almost like surreptitiously videotape some of this? So, you know, you can show it later exactly what this person, because we have the iPhones now, you can, you know, when your brother was injured, they didn't have video phones like an iPhone, I'm assuming, where you can just click and have a high resolution video. You know, is there ways that you would recommend to families to document this process, this pain, this torture, you know, in a way that's kind of not just telling story on a stand? That you'll do that either way, but is there a way to video or take photos or somehow record these, I guess, terrifying, terrible, painful procedures?
Yeah.
And situations.
I'm you know, I think with all our clients, we want them to do a good job of documenting, at least through photographs, bruises, you know, pre and post surgery, wounds of any kind, and particularly burns. I worry that surreptitiously videotaping a medical procedure might be perceived negatively by a jury. Yeah. So I probably wouldn't tell them to do that.
Or even afterwards, like, you know, what your, for example, your brother, like him laying in a bed, just shaking and wrestling himself around just in pain. You know, obviously your brother or the person may or may not know you're doing it. And I agree, you shouldn't videotape a procedure without even the doctor's permission, right?
Sure.
But I mean, to document as much as they can, I guess, is better for the case, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess
within reason.
Within reason and subject to the medical personnel being okay with it. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Document it. But you know, I think some of the best testimony is not from the burn survivor themselves, but the people who've been by their bedside, who can attest to, you know, I saw what he went through. I heard the screams, things of that nature.
And then most burn victims are left with horrible scarring, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that never goes away.
Well, the technology is getting better and better. And it's one of the things that the Phoenix Society is tied into is these release procedures and these skin grafts and these ointments and whatnot.
Okay.
You know, it's getting better.
But you can show that to a jury in a case. Unlike a broken bone or a procedure inside, they can't see.
Exactly.
You know, you might have an MRI or just think about a traumatic brain injury where it doesn't show anything on the MRI or the CAT scan, right? But we know there's a diffuse axonal injury or something like that.
Right.
You can't go and show that to a jury, but you can put the victim out there and pull their sleeve up or whatever it is, right? So there has to be a big impact on the jury.
I think it resonates with the jury much more so than an invisible injury like a TBI where you have to, through narrative, talk about, you know, Bob wandering the aisles at Costco and not realizing that he's there to pick up the cake or whatnot. And that's, I think, like you say, pulling up the sleeve and showing a severe.
And you probably went before and after witnesses, we'll call him. So this is how Bob was before the explosion. He lived this great, you know, fruitful life. And now this is where he is in this different state. Psychologically, he's got to be in a different place too, right?
Yeah.
I know you're working on that with the mission and the group, but that doesn't mean everyone's good, right?
No. I mean, from my own perspective, and this is not as a trial lawyer or an attorney, just as a family member of a burn survivor. I mean, when we were that 18 months starting in December of 1989, that seemed like we would never come out of that at all. Not even just changed and as the same people and family, but like that just seemed to be the darkest of places that, you know, I'm still kind of shocked that we survived it. It was that bleak for that long. And you know, only if you've gone through something like that yourself can you get that perspective.
And Danny was burned. So how much of his body was burned?
I want to say 80%, give or take, 80%. Second and third degree burns.
So there wasn't a time that he was out of it for a while, right? Like his chance of living was probably pretty slim for a long time.
Right? It was. I mean, they were giving him last rites the first day.
And you credit the doctors and the care?
Amazing doctors in the burn center. Yeah, it was in East Meadow, Long Island, Nassau University Medical Center. They just had tremendous care. The nurses, the doctors, everybody just really chipped in to save his life.
So burn centers, like, what should our audience know? Obviously, I would assume a burn center is kind of where the doctors and the staff are trained to treat burns. But what sets them apart? Do they have different equipment? Do they have different procedures, different surgical rooms? Like, how would you describe a burn center compared to a regular hospital?
I may not be the best person to answer that question. usually it will be, you know, a wing of 20 beds, by way of example, devoted specifically to the care burn survivors. I know I've used the term burn victims in our podcast here today.
Yeah.
They prefer survivors as opposed to victim. And I think that's an important, you know, psychological distinction.
Yeah.
The tanks, for example, the expertise, it takes a special person to want to work on a burn unit. And these doctors and nurses that devote their careers to whether it's substantially or fully working with and on burn survivors, it really takes a special breed. It's gut-wrenching stuff.
Wow. So your practice is partly burn, partly catastrophic, and then you do some other things. You do like truck accidents and auto and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny when you start out as a young personal injury lawyer, probably you're taking whatever you can get. And it's the oh my neck, oh my back case that comes into your office from a fender bender. And, you know, not that those people aren't deserving of compensation at times, but it's so much more rewarding, as you know, to be able to change the financial trajectory of an injured person and their family. Significant or catastrophic injury.
And psychologically, you're part of their team, right?
Oh, yeah.
You have to get this person in the right framework to treat, right? To carry through, to fight with you.
Document. Right? Yeah.
And you got to be, they're part of the team. It's almost like a partnership, I call it, the injured person and the lawyer.
Absolutely.
So you got to bring them along psychologically, like as a coach, almost mentor.
And honestly, you know, when I get in the big cases, when I'm visiting burn units or I'm visiting, you know, hospitals for people who are catastrophically injured. You know, my pitch to them is, I've been there. I know where you're at, and I know right now legal action is the furthest thing from your mind.
Yeah,
it should be about the care and treatment of your loved one, but at the same time, this is a really important time that we get in there and we document evidence and we can send our fire origin expert out to the scene before, you know, the evidence has
all
destroyed.
Yeah.
So that's a constant kind of conversation that I have to have with people who are.
But that's real world, real experience credibility. Like this, you've lived this. You're now, your mission now to help burn victims, give them a better life, help recovery. If someone else caused this negligently or recklessly, your mission in life is to help get as much as you can for that burn victim's future.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Get them through the process.
Which, and sorry to interrupt you, which is more than they initially think, because particularly with burn survivors, they're going to need a new van every few years. They're going to need grab bars. They're going to need home health care aides. They're going to need a lot of things that they upfront may not consider. So the numbers, not to mention the millions of dollars of medical expenses and liens that you have from these extended hospital stays. They're significant cases, but you know, I hope it doesn't come across as just it's financially rewarding for the attorney. It's more about righting the wrong and getting the justice.
No, it sounds like it's your calling. You know, you've been through this. God put you through this if you believe in a God, and you've lived this, not at your choosing, but you've been able to take a negative, a real negative, and so is Danny, into a positive where he can help other burn victims, at least psychologically, right? And you're here helping them get through the process and financially. I think you make a good team.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I think you found your calling, and it's very inspiring to hear that, yeah. Thanks for coming on today.
Thanks for having me. This was great.
How can someone who knows someone or hears about someone or has a family member that's been in any kind of injury where somebody's burned, how can they get in touch with you?
You could Google us, Grauper and Najat in New York. You could look at the Phoenix Society. They have a legal hotline on their website. We're one of several firms that are part of that hotline. So you know, that's a way to do it through the Phoenix Society. Call Mike Sale.
I'll direct you over there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't think of somebody with a better story than you to represent burn victim, especially in New York where you practice.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, awesome. Thanks again for coming on.
My pleasure. This was wonderful.
Thanks for telling your story.
All right.